Hi, podcast listeners. It's Chris Boyd. On KERA Radio, we're busy hosting our winter membership campaign. It's one of the few times each year when we ask listeners to support the programming that KERA provides by making financial contributions to the station. Well, we've decided to experiment with cutting those pitch breaks from the podcast. You won't hear the phone number and wonder if anyone is actually standing by at that very moment to take your call. But we would still really appreciate it if you are able to contribute. Your donation goes to support all the programming you hear on KERA, including our streaming service. And most importantly, it pays for this podcast so that you can listen to Think wherever you are in the world, whenever you are in time. You can make your contribution online at kera.org. It only takes a minute. In fact, you could do it while listening to this podcast. Thanks for listening to Think. Here's today's show.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What value can be found in personal and professional setbacks, and why do some people come to believe that painful losses have a silver lining? The reality is that many new ventures are destined to disappoint, if not fail outright, meaning people whose efforts do succeed have to be willing to take risks. And as my guest today will tell us, those who discover and embrace the lessons of their own previous defeats and false starts can gain important advantages. Megan McArdle is a columnist at Bloomberg View. Her new book is called The Upside of Down: Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Megan, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So right off the top in this book, you confess blithely that you are a spectacular failure. Talk about what you meant by that.
I have failed so many times that, you know, it sounds great on my resume, actually. I've worked for all these startups and so forth. And, of course, the reason I've worked for all these startups is that they kept going out of business. I also got out of business school in 2001, had a job lined up with a management consulting firm, and then got laid off without ever starting and spent 2 years trying to find a permanent full-time job. And really, when I was at the end of my rope, I looked at this blog that I'd started where I was talking a lot about my business school curriculum, economics, public policy, accounting, and realized that I loved this more than anything I'd ever done and that I was going to try to pursue this as a career. Eventually got a job at The Economist, which was amazing and was the start of an amazing 12-year career. But what I realized afterwards was that if I hadn't had that 2 years, which was honestly often quite miserable, as anyone who's been unemployed can attest, that I wouldn't have had the courage to take this job that paid a third of what I'd been expecting at the management consulting firm and with my $1,000 a month in student loan payments and just say, okay, well, that's a stretch, but I'm going to make it work. I probably would have stayed in something less risky but also less fulfilling. And so you talk to entrepreneurs and entertainers and athletes and so forth, and a lot of them have that story of, you know, I started it because I had failed at something else. The guy who runs my company, Mike Bloomberg, you know, he left Salomon with a $10 million severance and used it to start Bloomberg, which is the most fantastically successful media company perhaps of all time. So.
Of course, leaving with a $10 million severance is always helpful, but yes.
Yes, but on the other hand, you know, he could have just taken that and gone and bought an island somewhere, and instead he took a new risk and decided, no, I want to take a chance and try to really do something big. And, of course, he did something really big.
So no matter how cautious we try to be, we all fail at things, right? And for the most part, we survive those failures and we move on. So why do we continue to fear failure?
Because failure feels bad. I mean, in a sense, it should feel bad. Failure is nature's way of saying, stop, that doesn't work. And if it didn't feel bad, we wouldn't stop doing it. There's also a social stigma on failure. You know, we tend to look at people who failed, and there's an instinct to think, well, they must have done something specially wrong, because if you don't think to yourself, well, they did something really stupid or bad, then, of course, it could happen to you. And that combination of isolation and just the natural feelings of aversion that we have to failure mean that a lot of people try to engineer it out of their lives, and we're getting more that way. I mean, you can really see in America that over the last 50 years, we've gotten much more risk-averse. A lot of people are really trying to cling to the things they think are guarantees, whether it's a job at a big corporation or that college or graduate school degree that's supposed to guarantee you a good job. But if you look at my story, I graduated from a top five business school. There's certainly no guarantees And if you look at the financial crisis, when we thought that the regulators had engineered the risk out of the system because they were so good at their jobs, that was the most dangerous place that we were. That was when we were setting ourselves up for another huge failure that was worse because we weren't prepared. And, you know, really there is no place quite as dangerous as safe.
So risk aversion is counterproductive.
Absolutely, because you cannot – now, you want to try to fail smartly. Mm-hmm. You want to prepare. You want to always have backup plans. I think of it as hedging your net psychic wealth. but you also want to, when you are taking risks, you want to be taking calculated risks. Never put everything on red and hope that the roulette wheel turns out right. You want to be diversified. You want to have backup plans. And you also want to make sure that you're never risking so much that if you fail, it's a complete catastrophe. And you look at companies that do this well, that fail smartly, and part of that is failing quickly and saying, oh, that didn't work. Okay, we're not going to spend more money chasing that. We're going to shut it down because it didn't work. Those are the companies that really tend to have an edge in the marketplace.
Well, I guess the first step, following on what you just said, in learning from failure is actually recognizing that we have failed, which can surprisingly be more challenging than we might imagine.
Well, yes, because failure feels bad, and so we protect ourselves from feeling bad by not admitting it's happened.
It's fine. Everything's fine. Right.
And also, you know, we do have these very deep cognitive biases towards not admitting loss. There's something called normalcy bias, which is when we act as if things are normal even when they clearly aren't. And you see this in plane crashes, for example, where you think in disasters that the real risk is that everyone's screaming and trampling each other trying to get to the exit. But in fact, the big killer in plane crashes is that people don't move fast enough. They sit in their seats too long, and there's a huge danger of smoke and fire when they should be getting out quickly, leaving their luggage, and recognizing, okay, the most important thing is getting out, no luggage, move as quickly as I can. And they don't do that. It's so deep that even when a plane has crashed, this cognitive bias that keeps us from recognizing, okay, things have changed and I have to change with them.
So how does failure help us to develop better judgment?
Well, there's an old saying that good judgment comes from experience and experience comes from bad judgment. and it really is true, is that one of my favorite examples of this is that an experimental economics lab that I talk about in Chapter 2 actually did a series of experiments where they used students as traders in a marketplace, and they did an asset market, like a stock market. And they were really surprised because they saw bubbles, just like you get in the stock market and the housing market and so forth. And what they realized after they ran these experiments a few times was they always got the bubbles eventually, and that the only way to get rid of the bubbles was to have the same people do the exercise over and over again. And the second or third time, they began to see the pattern. They began to see how things were being set up for failure, and they avoided it. And you need that experience of, oh, yeah, I did this, and it didn't work out. We can learn from other people's examples, but often everyone has this experience of you go and do something, and then you have a terrible time, and you get out the other side, and you've learned a really valuable lesson, and you look back and you realize that was a really valuable lesson that my parents were trying to tell me when I was 15.
Well, let's talk about that, because every parent wants to sort of, you know, tell their kids, I made these mistakes, I don't want you to make them, listen to me. Is it actually possible, Megan, to learn from others' failures, or do we have to personally experience these things to reap the real benefits?
It is possible, but you have to be really dedicated to it. And then sometimes, even then, so I actually went out to that economics lab where they do these experiments and they show all sorts of irrational behavior where people aren't getting as much value because they actually pay them real money, where people aren't making as much money as they could. And I was with a group of very smart people, journalists, academics, and we all actually read the papers that these experiments were based on, and we still didn't do it right. There's some things that you just need to experience yourself. However, you can, by learning the categories of mistakes that people make and being really conscious of, first of all, assuming that failure is part of the process. You never start out assuming, well, failure is not an option, because nature thinks it's an option whether you do or not. But the second thing is then to understand, okay, because it's an option, I need to be alert to it. And I need to have thought about ways in which other people have failed at this before me and be alert to those particular errors, whether it's in a relationship because, you know, women's magazines are filled with the stories of people who made relationship mistakes, or a business, or, you know, raising your kids, or all sorts of personal life things. If you want to make sure that you avoid mistakes, you have to be on the lookout for them all the time and understand that they can happen to you.
So after a failure, we try to analyze what went wrong, and often the first place we look is outside of ourselves, right? It was somebody else's fault.
Yes, I call it blame storming, mm-hmm. because it's you know, it's like brainstorming, except we're looking for someone to blame.
Right.
And it's incredibly common. Everyone who's worked for an organization has sat through that meeting where we all sit down and try to figure out whose fault it was, except not ours.
Right.
And it's really counterproductive in a lot of ways. First of all, there are things that are the fault of one guy. You know, Bernie Madoff, he did something wrong, and it was his fault. But most failures aren't like that. Most failures are systemic failures. There were a lot of people involved. There were teams of people who made decisions. And there were also factors outside of your control. You know, there were people in Germany who lost their jobs because U.S. homeowners took out too big mortgages on their houses. And so when you're looking for a villain, you're not looking at the system. You're not looking at those collective mistakes or those impersonal forces that may have caused this. And then the problem is, you think, oh, well, I've identified the villain. I can just fix it by getting rid of the bad person.
Hmm.
It feels very cozy to feel that. It's much more reassuring than collectively 300 Americans went crazy about the housing market. But the problem with that is that then you get rid of that guy and you haven't actually changed the stuff in the system that made it break down.
Megan McArdle is my guest. She's a columnist at Bloomberg View and author of the new book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372, sending email to think@kera.org, or sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Back in 2 minutes with Megan McArdle.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Summer Youth, with more than 30 new programs for students entering kindergarten through 12th grade at SMU in Plano from June through August. Registration opens March 5th at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Bloomberg View columnist Megan McArdle. Her new book is called The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Megan, is it important to draw a distinction between a mistake and a failure?
Yes. Very important. So a failure is... Let me actually start with a mistake. A mistake is something that you do that you shouldn't do. It's a bad process, but it doesn't result in a bad outcome. And so the example I always give is nurses and doctors and so forth who don't wash their hands in between touching patients. And we know from studies that almost no one in the healthcare field uses proper sanitary procedure all of the time. A lot of the estimates are about a third of the time they don't. They fail to do that. But most of the time, nothing happens. You touch the patient, they don't get any sicker, they leave the hospital perfectly healthy. Unfortunately, a tiny percentage of the time, they do get very sick because you did this, and they can die. So a mistake is all of those times that you didn't wash your hands or otherwise follow a sterile procedure the way that you should have. The failure is the few times that actually results in harm to a patient.
Hmm. Can we learn things from failures that are attributable mostly or entirely to just bad luck?
You can. You know, certainly, for example, a job loss is a big one, mm-hmm. where often, as I say, with the German people who lost their jobs because American homeowners did a fairly silly thing, it's not your fault that you got laid off. You just happened to work for a company that had setbacks. Nonetheless, there is a great deal to be learned in how you address that challenge. So I think of employment as like a dark room. You stumble in and they close the door and there's no light and suddenly you don't know where the exit is. And the temptation is, because it's scary and dark, to sit down because you can't see where you're going. But that's really dangerous, especially now, because what we can see in studies of resumes and also in the ads saying no unemployed need apply, once your resume has a big gap on it over about 6 months, you have a much harder time finding another job. So what you should be doing is keeping moving, even though there's a phenomenal amount of rejection and dejection that accompanies job searching. I mean, essentially, you're going out and saying, hey, would you like to reject me? And a lot of people say, yes, I would.
Yeah.
So it's psychologically very, very draining. People who are unemployed report that job seeking is the worst thing that they do all day, but it's also the most important thing that they do all day. And so what you need to learn is how to cope with this, to keep up that job search intensity, even if you're not sure that it's doing any good, and even though it feels bad. If you can do that, you're going to take away something tremendous from the experience, because you're going to take away not only the knowledge that if it happens again, you can go out there and find another job, but you're also going to have taken a lot of key skills in terms of using your networks and reaching out to people and doing things that feel really, frankly, uncomfortable. Those are valuable skills to have, and unfortunately, they're the kinds of skills that we tend to learn in those moments of adversity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Greg in Fort Worth. Hello, Greg.
Hi, how you doing? I really enjoy this conversation. I'm currently in my own startup. This is my fourth startup, but the first one I've been running myself, and I try and hire people who have at least two failures in their past, because I think when they have a couple of failures in their past, they're better able to understand the distinction between embracing success and avoiding failure. And I think sometimes people in their you know, honest desire to avoid failure end up looking at those markers and those indicators for when things are failing. And they don't really look at what is the successful response here to an adverse event, you know? So I see people who have had a couple of failures able to say, okay, I see this problem is happening. And what I think we should have done in the past when this happened was X, because that would have made us successful, as opposed to other people, I think, who haven't had that kind of failure in their background, look at things that are going badly and say, oh my God, I can't believe this is going so badly. We thought things were going to go so great. And they end up dealing with the negative indicator and never really finding a positive, successful response.
What do you think about that, Megan?
I think it's completely true. You know, Professor Steve Tellis likes to say that there's three ways you can respond when your plan isn't working. You can say, actually, the data are wrong and my plan is working. You can say, wow, my plan's not working. We should do something differently. Or you can say, my plan is working. There's something wrong with reality. We just need to do more of the plan. Or I guess you can just fall apart and not do anything. But, you know, it's really true. And the thing is that middle thing, that say, oh, wow, my plan's not working, we need to change something, that's a really hard place for people to get to. And when you have people who haven't failed before, it's especially difficult to say, because failure seems so catastrophic. How can you admit that it's happening? Whereas people who've been through it, if they can show, yeah, we failed and we learned from it, this is what I learned from that experience, those people are the people who are going to recognize it happening, who are going to be able to say, yeah, we tried this in that situation before and it didn't work. This looks much better. They're a huge asset to companies. And, you know, this is one of the things America is actually relatively good at, is that they're willing to take a chance on people who failed before. And often that's spectacularly valuable for just the reason that the caller says, which is that these people have really valuable information about what doesn't work. And ultimately, that information gives you information about what does work.
Well, let's talk more about that, because you discovered some really interesting things about the way we frame failure in America that makes it a potentially positive phenomenon as compared with our counterparts in other economically successful countries, say in Europe.
Yes, we tend to think of failure as something that happens because you were doing a good thing, you were taking a risk, you were trying, you have great gumption and grit, and we really admire that. In a lot of European countries, starting a business, especially starting one of these, you know, not I started my own bakery, but I tried to start my own company making a product no one's ever sold before, tend to view those things a little bit suspiciously. It's a little crazy. It might not work. Why would you leave a good job at a big company to do that? But those little companies that start, those are the secret to, those are the engine of American economic growth, and they're a tremendous asset to us. And, you know, so Europe is actually trying to change this. You look at the EU, they talk a lot about why don't we have as many entrepreneurs, why aren't we encouraging people more to get into the marketplace and go out and see if they can do something that no one's ever done before and explore the frontier? And they're trying, but we have a built-in advantage because we're a country descended from all the people who got up and said, hey, I'm going to go explore another frontier.
And there is a bit of a social stigma attached to bankruptcy, which most people might agree is appropriate, but it's not impossible to pick up and start over again after a financial catastrophe here.
Yes, this is one of the things I think people are most surprised in my book, because I have an entire chapter devoted to explaining why bankruptcy really is the hidden secret to American success that no one ever talks about. Mm. It's tremendously powerful. So most people don't realize that American bankruptcy law is far more generous than bankruptcy law in other countries. We are much more likely to reorganize a company that is failing than to just liquidate them and sell off whatever assets we can. And we're also, with individual debt, you know, other countries don't have Chapter 7 the way we do, where you can just go into a judge and say, look, I don't have any, I borrowed a lot of money, I can't pay it, I don't really have any money, I have $300 in my bank account. And the judge says, okay, well, give me the $300, I'll distribute it among your creditors, and I'm discharging your debt. That's not a thing anywhere else. And people are so surprised by it that I was actually interviewing an expert on a completely different topic. He's a Russia expert. And he just started making fun of American bankruptcy law in the middle of this interview, which was funny to me because he's Scandinavian. And you would think they're all everything easy and forgiveness. But in fact, Scandinavian bankruptcy law is really tough. And I interviewed a Danish entrepreneur who is still struggling with debt from 10 years ago because he can't declare bankruptcy. And that's the thing that you actually see in America. We have this neat little natural experiment, which is that our bankruptcy law is federal, but the exemptions, how much you can shield from your creditors, are local to each state, and some are really generous and some aren't. States with more generous exemptions have more entrepreneurship, and there's two reasons for that. One is that it's a lot easier to take a risk if you're not going to lose the house, but the other reason is that we don't have people like that Danish entrepreneur who just get shackled to that old debt he's been struggling with for 10 years since he had to lay off some workers in 2001. They don't get shackled to it and unable to move on. You take those people, you put them back to work on new enterprises where they're creating new value for themselves and the economy.
And then people are in a position to take whatever valuable lessons they've learned from their own failures and apply them to the next thing they attempt.
Exactly. And that's hugely valuable. And it's also hugely valuable because people are very valuable. And, you know, everyone makes mistakes sometimes, even really dumb mistakes. There are a lot of people in this country who bought way more house than they could reasonably afford, and they shouldn't have. But, you know, it was kind of a natural mistake to make. It had worked for a lot of people before them. And we can focus a lot on punishing them, or we can focus them on saying, that was a huge mistake. Let's figure out how we move on from that mistake as quickly as possible. And people and companies and countries that move on are the countries that have the most dynamic organizations, the most dynamic economies, and the most dynamic lives, because they don't get stuck. And that is the kind of core message of this book, is failing well is about making sure that you don't get stuck, you learn what you can, and you move on.
How can we make the best decisions about when to persist through what may be a challenge and what may be a sort of slow failure in progress?
That is always tricky. Mm-hmm. And there's no one perfect answer to it. But the first thing is you really need to understand why things are going wrong. So if you're looking at your business and you can say to yourself, okay, we're losing money every month, but the reason we're losing money every month is our cost structure, and we have a high fixed cost for a plant or something, but our sales are growing every month, and I can see that in 12 or 14 months we could be at the point where we're breaking even. That's a good story for staying in business, even if it's not what you expected when you went into business. But if you're looking at it, and a lot of entrepreneurs, especially in tech, will say this, is we had this great product and everyone loved it, but we couldn't get them to pay us for it. Hmm. Well, if you can't figure out how to monetize it, then you really need to say, look, it was a great idea and clearly people love it, but it's not a profitable idea and we need to shut it down. So what you need to say is, can I explain this failure and then can I fix it? You need to be really ruthless about that. Don't say, well, if something that isn't happening now and that I don't have any realistic way of making happening happened, then everything would be great. You have to say, well, there's something I can do right now that with very high probability is going to change things substantially. Then, you know, keep on keeping on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking with Bloomberg View columnist Megan McArdle. Her new book is called The Upside of Down: Why Failing Well is the Key to Success.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Summer Youth, with more than 30 new programs for students entering kindergarten through 12th grade at SMU in Plano from June through August. Registration opens March 5th at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Megan McArdle. She is a columnist and at Bloomberg View and author of the new book, The Upside of Down: Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Megan, another interesting thing you do here is find that some of our responses to failure can sort of be traced back to our hunter-gatherer ancestors.
Yes, the farmers and foragers theory. This was actually a little bit of serendipity. I ended up talking to an anthropologist who was doing experimental economics with the team that I went to interview at Chapman University. And so what I discovered was something that I hadn't known, which is that, you know, chimpanzees are they're violent, they're status-oriented, they're hierarchical, they don't share very well, but hunter-gatherers are like the opposite of that. There's basically no status hierarchy, there's no I'm better than this person's less than me. They live in small, usually held together by family bands of 25 to 50 people, and they share a lot. And, you know, it varies by band, but the tribe that he had studied was a group called the Ache of Paraguay, who actually had such strong morals about sharing that they said that a hunter who eats from his own kill will lose the ability to hunt.
Hmm.
And so, you know, this has often been painted as a kind of Edenic thing from which we fell when agriculture came along, and there's a lot of theories about why this is. But his theory was that because he had actually watched the Ache transition to agriculture and saw that as they transitioned, very suddenly, they stop sharing so much. And a lot of the theories about why agricultural societies tend to be much more hierarchical, a little bit more like chimps. They share less, they're more hierarchical, they're much more about this is mine and that's yours, have to do with, oh, well, people got more surplus and they used that to hire guys with weapons and then they developed. And what he said was, no, it's not. It's actually a rational response to the environment. So when you're hunting, you know, as you said, you can carve a hole in the ice and you can wait for hours, but if a seal doesn't show up, you're not going to eat that day. Hmm. And then if you do get a seal, you're going to get thousands, hundreds of thousands more calories than you can eat. And so sharing is a way of, it's insurance, basically. It's a way of mitigating risk. But when you're doing agriculture, the line between your work and the reward is much cleaner. It's much, I did this and then that happened. There's much less variability in the food supply, and so people tend to then, you need to incentivize work. And so what he said about the Ache was the reason they developed property rights was that they rang a bell in the morning to go to the fields the way they had formerly done to go hunting, and no one showed up. So they needed property rights to get people to actually do the work, and that's actually what the Pilgrims also discovered. A lot of people don't know that. They tried to farm communally, and they couldn't. They almost were wiped out by a famine. So when you think about someone who's failed, a lot depends on whether you think of them the way a forager does or the way a farmer does. Are you thinking, well, primarily the universe is pretty predictable and this person must not have done the work? Or are you thinking, well, primarily it depends on whether you get lucky? And there's a big divide between Europe and America and how we think. Europe tends to treat failed entrepreneurs as in a farming way. They tend to think, oh, well, you must not have worked hard enough or you must be stupid. And Americans tend to think of it like foragers. And then we reverse that when you look at people who are at the bottom of the income scale. And my argument is that in a big modern economy where you never can predict entirely what the outcome of your action is going to be because there are so many people involved and because it's so complicated. I mean, if my bank failed, I don't know why it failed. I don't have the ability to know half of what should have gone on in a bank. And that's true of virtually every job. You just have to act as if, look, it's complex and it's not predictable, and so there's going to be a lot of failure, And we need to forgive that and not treat it as a moral failing.
So contrary to many people's instincts, it turns out we are not doing our children any favors by shielding them from failure. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we really aren't. I had a girl come up to me and at a talk that I gave the other day, and she said, you know, I agree. Failing is really important, and it sounds like I should be taking risks, but look, I need to get a 4.0, and I can't take the risk of taking any class that I'm not going to get an A in. Hmm. And I thought, yeah, America, you're doing it wrong. If you can't fail when you're 15, when's the right time going to be? When you're looking for an assisted living facility? I mean, you have to be able to, at this age of all times, is when failure should be least costly. And instead, we've set up this system where people just don't feel like they can take any risk because getting that selective college admissions is so important that everything else has to fall by the wayside. And the problem is that you produce kids that aren't resilient. Hmm. They're terrified of failing. They've never had the experience, really. They've always had an adult hovering over them, shepherding them through setting up a carefully structured system where everything is very clear what you're supposed to do next and do you jump the hoop. And that's not the way the real world works. And so you are seeing, and generally I have to say, I'm really skeptical of these young people. the millennials, they're harder working than my generation was, and they're much more focused. But managers, even managers who have managed multiple generations, really do say they expect so much structure and so much feedback and so much constant, like school. And that's really not the way the world is. And you're hearing that from a lot of people, and they get really scared when they run into an environment where there's not that level of coaching and control.
Well, and it turns out that building a tolerance for calculated risk starts pretty young.
It does, even in kindergarten. You look at what parents say to kids. It's so important. And because there's basically two ways you can approach a challenge. You can approach it with what's called a fixed mindset, where you think, this challenge is going to measure how much talent I have. Or you can approach a challenge by saying, wow, this challenge is going to be an opportunity for me to find out what I don't know and learn. And a lot of people, including a lot of very successful people, tend to be those fixed mindset people because they were successful young. And so their thought is that it's just all natural talent. But of course, people who are really successful, people who are at the head of innovative new industries or the best journalists or whatever, those are people you have to be able to tolerate failure because it's going to come to everyone who tries a big challenge. And so developing that growth mindset is key. And if you think about the way we talk to kids, we say, oh, you did really well on your test. You must be so smart. Hmm. Well, what are you telling that kid? That it's something, that success is something you are, that it's about finding work easy, and it's something you are, not something you do. Sending exactly the wrong message, and all the language of gifted and talented programs just reinforces that message that this is fundamentally about something you were born with, not something you can develop, and that's really incorrect. Outside of grade school, that's just rarely the case that the most successful person is going to be the person who just had all of this natural ability. So you need to develop early. Instead of telling kids, oh, you know, you must be really smart, you say, oh, you must have worked really hard. And the psychologist who tested this, a woman named Carol Dweck, she was shocked at the magnitude of the effect that she found on how much these kids were willing to try and learn when you framed success as a matter of the effort that you put in, rather than the effort that you just came to the challenge with, the talent that you came to the challenge with.
So how should we think about the potential for failure as we undertake something new that might carry with it a little bit of risk?
Well, the first thing is don't bet the farm.
Uh-huh.
You always want to have backup plans. You don't ever want to be putting all of your eggs in one basket. You always want to have... You're taking a calculated risk. You're never betting the whole company. You're never betting your whole life on one thing. But the second thing, then, is that you have to be alert to understand, because you understand that failure is a real possibility, you have to be alert to saying, okay, well, we're watching for that. If it happens, we're going to sit down, set hard deadlines. Say, you know, when my husband, shortly after we moved in together, he lost his job. And he said he knew he was going to marry me because instead of freaking out, I said, okay, well, we're going to sit down because I'd been through it. I was unemployed for 2 years. I said, we're going to set deadlines and we're going to say at this point we break our lease, at this point we sell one of our cars and so forth. Because I knew that if we got to that point, it would be so wrenching. So you set the deadlines in advance for when are we going to evaluate this and what are the metrics we're going to evaluate with. That's really important. And then the third thing is, after it's happened, don't beat yourself up and, oh, I'm a failure. You're not a failure. You're someone who's failed. Everyone on the planet who's successful has also failed. Winston Churchill and Ulysses S. Grant and Abraham Lincoln, huge failures before they were great men. So you say to yourself, okay, well, that's part of it. It's not fun. I'm not going to pretend it's ever going to be fun because it's not. But if you don't beat yourself up, if you don't shame yourself and blame yourself for what's happened, okay, how do I move on the best way? And a lot of that is going to have to do with just keep moving. Don't think I need the best possible. I'm going to take 6 months and make a really great plan. Just do something. Whatever it is, looking for a job from a position of I do these five things. And even if you're employed at Walmart, it's better to be looking for a job from a job than not from a job because you're not desperate then.
Megan McArdle is a columnist at Bloomberg View and author of the new book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Megan, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.